Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The number of suspected or presumed coronavirus cases in Pennsylvania is now up to 6. That's according to the State Department of Health. Now that the COVID-19 virus has been detected closer to home, we know there are questions, and that's what we'll try to do on today's program, try to answer some of those questions. Joining us up front today, recorded earlier today, is WITS Transforming Health reporter Brett Shultes. Brett Shultes, welcome to Smart Talk.
Hey, Scott. Happy to be here.
Well, Brett is busy covering another coronavirus-related event this morning, but is joining us on the phone to provide the latest information. As I mentioned, Brett, now 6 cases are presumed here in Pennsylvania. What's the latest other than that?
That's right, Scott. We have this brings it up to that case in Wayne County, a case in Delaware County, and up to 4 cases in Montgomery County. So those cases are called presumed positive first because they send the results, the State Department of Health sends the results to the CDC for confirmation. That's a safe way of saying that they tested positive, but they're also, you know, sending those results to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to make sure, because there had been some instances early on where testing wasn't always 100% accurate. But that's 6 people in Pennsylvania. To put it in context a little bit, I think, I'll tell you, Scott, this is one of those where you have to be careful with numbers because they're changing so fast that, by the time I read it and say it to you, it might have changed. But the last that I saw this morning, I think it was 34 states that have had cases of coronavirus so far. And, you know, in context, there are about 101,000 cases worldwide. So we have had 476 cases in the U.S. and at least 19 deaths.
So, Brett, I know that one of the big questions when the governor and the secretary of health announced the first 2 cases on Friday is how did the people who have been presumed to have the coronavirus COVID-19, how did they get it? How did they come in contact with other people that they were able to acquire this?
That's a great question, and you know it's Monday morning, so we're still trying to get in touch with the Department of Health in terms of follow-ups to the two most recent cases, at least. Which the Department of Health sent that information out on a Sunday, which is great that they did that. I think they're making sure that people know as soon as possible. The thing we do know is that with the first couple of cases, it was not what's called community spread. Community spread would mean that, you are, for example, you or I had it, went to work, and then someone else who you came in touch with either through work or through your home life or going to the grocery store got it. These were cases that were related to travel. In one instance, it was international travel. We know that at least one person of the 6 who have this in Pennsylvania had traveled to a level 3 risk advisory country. The Department of Health didn't say exactly the name of that country. An example of a level 3 risk advisory country would be Italy or Iran. Those are countries that we've been warned not to travel there. And in fact, at this point, travel there would be very difficult because of airlines shutting down flights and things like that, and as well as quarantines. So we know one person traveled internationally. We also know that somebody traveled to Pennsylvania from another state. So there's at least one instance where someone was in a state. We don't know the name of that state, but it could have been California or Washington, one of those states that had those established cases.
And according to the latest, I just got a release from the State Department of Health. They're saying that all 6 cases that the people traveled to a country or state with known community outbreaks or have come in contact with someone who has the virus. So that goes along the same lines as what you were talking about with the Friday cases. So how has the state responded, Brett?
The state has declared a disaster emergency, which is a broad category, as you know, that could allow for an emergency after a hurricane or an earthquake or some kind of natural disaster. And it's also the same disaster emergency declaration that the state declared as a result of the opioid crisis. Now, having spoken with Governor Wolf on this last week, I know that that's not what he would prefer to do. He's pushing the state legislature right now to pass a bill that would, and I know this can almost sound a little like, you know what, we have a health outbreak and they're trying to pass a bill. But this is something that's been ongoing for quite some time. There's a bill in the state house right now to allow for a public health emergency declaration. And the reason that the governor wants that is because it makes it easier to attach or access funding and have a health emergency that's specific to something like this. So at any rate, that's one thing that they have going on is that they've declared this emergency declaration. They set up a sort of a command center, as they like to call it, and they're extensively monitoring anybody who has come into contact with the people who have confirmed cases. So they do something called contact tracing, which would be sort of like, determining who you may have come into contact with and then sort of walking through those people to see if anybody else might have been at risk for infection or been infected.
Something else that I know a lot of people have questions about, and that is how to get tested. I mean, right now, we have one lab that was established, a laboratory established in Exton in Chester County last week that is testing for cases. The Department of Health announced that there would be commercial labs that would be coming on board, maybe even as soon as this week. But people are saying, well, where do I get tested? I don't have to go to Exton to get tested for this. How do they go about that?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's one that I've had people asking me that as well. First of all, you know, we're not doing anything differently here than you would do if you felt that you had the flu or that you suspected that you had some other kind of virus or illness. You're going to go to your doctor, and if your doctor determines that it's medically necessary to have you tested for this, then the doctor's going to take a sample, and that sample's going to be sent out. Now, You are right. Things are changing so quickly. I'm almost hesitant to say, for example, what their ability is right now in terms of how many tests they can perform each day or each week. I know at first it was only a handful each day, and then they got it up to 20 to 25. And now the state has said that as of this week, some of the commercial testing facilities were going to be online. So that should greatly increase the ability to perform tests. I would sort of say for the average person who feels like they might be sick or their family member or loved one might be sick, I would encourage them to not think about where they're going to get tested, but instead think about very, very quickly getting themselves to their medical provider. Because those people have been briefed on all this stuff and have a sort of flowchart, actually, that they follow through in order to determine, hey, are you at elevated risk for having contracted this? Not to mention, of course, they can just look at your symptoms.
And what are those symptoms? I mean, we have an infectious disease specialist appearing a little bit later, just in a few minutes, on the program who can talk about this specifically. But I can just picture our audience. Many of them have heard about the symptoms up until now, but it is always wise to talk about what those symptoms are and when someone should call their doctor, make an appointment, go to the doctor to be tested.
Yeah, and I'll be really looking forward to hearing the second part of your show as well, to hear from that infectious disease specialist, because it is fascinating to learn how this spreads and also how it's killed, because it really truly is amazing the way that soap, for example, does kill this. And so I know sometimes people can fear that something like this is just going to be everywhere and unstoppable. But it really is a testament to, follow the guidelines they give you and wash your hands, because Well, I'm sure the infectious disease specialist will get into it. It really does work to kill this virus. But to your question, the main symptoms here, Scott, are symptoms that could be similar in some ways to what you'd experience with the flu, with a couple key differences. So a high percentage of people who had this illness, I think it was about 88%, reported having a fever. Many people reported having a cough, a dry cough, that might feel a little bit different than what you'd have with a flu. A lot of people also reported having, some people reported having shortness of breath. Additionally, there were symptoms like watery eyes, sore throat, and runny nose, which were less common. So that's, you know, as it can be with some of these illnesses, you're not always going to have the full range of symptoms. And also, as we're all seeing now on Facebook and social media, there are people who are getting a sore throat. They're worried that they have COVID-19. They go to their doctor, and they're ecstatic to learn that they have tested positive for the flu.
Yeah, and you know? That is rather ironic, you know?
Right. It is. And the flu is not as statistically dangerous as COVID-19, but the flu kills. The flu has killed thousands of people this year, and so it's, of course, also can be a very serious thing. But, those are the main symptoms, Scott.
Well, that's, see, one of the issues, and Brett, I'm sure that, you know, as you're talking to people who ask, it comes up fairly often, is those symptoms that you just described could be a lot of things, could be the flu, could be the cold, some kind of upper respiratory illness. If someone, it would be very easy for someone with those symptoms to say, oh, I just have a cold, I just have the flu. So I guess my big question is, how do they make the decision to go to the doctor and say, I need tested for COVID-19?
Well, I think the short answer is, I don't think a person does need to say they need tested for COVID-19. I think that if a person is sick, they should go to the doctor because it's the right thing to do, and the doctor is going to guide them in their treatment. And whether the result is that they have the flu or that they have COVID-19, then they're going to pursue the course action from there. I guess the only thing is that maybe I'll walk that statement back a little bit, because the difference here is that we really want to know if a person has had COVID-19 because of its transmissibility, and because it is still novel, it is still new in this state and in this area. So, you know, I think one of the pieces of guidance I was seeing was that people should call rather than just show up first. Call in, let that medical practitioner know what they're experiencing. But again, the doctor or whoever you would typically go to for medical care, even if it's an urgent care facility, that should be your first point of contact. The Department of Health has also set up ways that you can reach out to them to get more information as well. So the Department of Health's website is a great resource right now. I know a lot of times, you know, you can mention a website and you go on there and there's nothing that up to date. But I can tell you that right now with this going on, that site and other government sites like the Centers for Disease Control Prevention site are being updated regularly. So to your point, I think, you know, we don't necessarily know, and that's a little bit of the frustration with this, is that people are making decisions out of an abundance of caution or just out of a little bit of panic, and it's, you know, it's changing the way we're living our lives. It's changing what we're doing. I mean, big events are being canceled. The South by Southwest event that's in Austin, Texas every year is a huge event, was canceled for the year. Sporting events are being canceled, so it's definitely changing our lives.
Brett, on the other side of that, though, you mentioned Facebook. and I see this on social media all the time over the past week or so, is that even though there are people that are changing their lives drastically in some cases, preparing for maybe being quarantined for a couple of weeks, there are those that are not taking this seriously. They think that the media has overhyped it and that they compare it to other times where there have been diseases or illnesses like SARS or the Ebola scare of a few years ago. And those people don't seem to be taking it as seriously. They do think it's being overhyped. They are not being cautious, or at least they say they're not being cautious. Is there any reason to believe that they're right?
I think that's a great question. I do think, you know, one of the ironies of a concerted public health response to a potential epidemic or pandemic, one of the ironies of that is that the better job we do of maintaining it, then at the end of it, when it's all said and done, the more those naysayers can come in and say, see, that wasn't that bad. You know, but the fact is an enormous amount of resources are being devoted to this right now. And that is helping to prevent, at least so far, I don't want to speak too soon, but at least so far, we don't see something like we saw in China or like we saw in Italy, which, by the way, China eventually really got it right and imposed some pretty draconian or extreme measures to, to halt the spread of this. But, I think, you know, that's what we're seeing right now is a strong public health response that hopefully is going to allow those people on Facebook who love to be experts on everything. It's going to allow them to say, well, you know, maybe we overhyped it. But before I go too far down that road, let me just give you a couple facts additionally. One of the things that makes this different than something like you mentioned SARS. Well, this is a SARS, actually, in a sense, but you mentioned Ebola. But some of these other viruses and illnesses we've had throughout the years, there is an aspect to any illness that is called its RO, or its transmissibility. And that means how likely is it that for every person who gets this, it will be spread to one person additionally, or maybe it will be spread to two people additionally. Now, typically with a lot of the most virulent and just fatal illnesses like Ebola, that has a relatively low transmissibility rating, because by the time somebody is contagious, they're grievously ill, and so they've probably been put in the hospital. In this case, the transmissibility score is high because people can be contagious even as they are relatively asymptomatic, especially for young, healthy people who might just feel like they're just a little bit under the weather. They can be going about their daily business and spreading this to other people. And, of course, we know that some groups of folks, especially older people and those with other underlying medical problems, can really have serious consequences as a result of this. So I don't think that it's I think, you know, people's personalities often come forward in this, where someone wants to say this is no big deal. Someone else wants to basically, you know, buy up all the toilet paper at their grocery store. I don't know if either of those is exactly right, but I definitely would caution people against pretending that this is just hyped by the media or something that isn't real.
Brett Shultes is WITF's Transforming Health reporter, and he's covering another event related to COVID-19, the coronavirus, this morning. Brett, thank you very much for your insights.
Yeah, happy to talk to you, Scott, and I'll have another update for you on that a little bit later today.
For more information on the coronavirus, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. And before we get into our conversation, resume our conversation about coronavirus, just want to mention a special event that's coming up later this week, WITS Smart Talk Road Trip, coming up this Thursday, an evening broadcast from the campus of Wilson College in Chambersburg. The broadcast begins at 7 p.m. and will include discussions of the many amazing alumni of Wilson College throughout history in honor of Women's History Month and the upcoming anniversary of Women's Right to Vote. RSVP at WITF.org/events if you would like to attend. Big auditorium, and we'd like to see you out there for the live broadcast this Thursday at 7 o'clock. Much of what we've heard about the coronavirus and the response to it has come from government entities. What about healthcare providers and their role in stemming the spread of the disease? Joining us on the phone now is Dr. John Goldman, infectious disease specialist with UPMC Pinnacle. Dr. Goldman, good to talk to you again.
Good to be back. Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, now this is an opportunity for you to ask those questions. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITS Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Goldman, you probably heard the end of my conversation with Brett Schultes. How is this different than other illnesses that where there have been health emergencies declared in the last decade or so?
Well, first of all, until it happens, we don't know that it is. And I personally think that it is going to be worse. I don't think it is going to be as bad as, for example, it was in China. But the people who say it's no different from other healthcare emergencies, I truly hope that they're absolutely correct. On the other hand, I feel as if it would be irresponsible to presume that they are. And I think it would be irresponsible not to prepare. In addition, the objective evidence that we have coming in out of outbreaks in other parts of the world is that it almost certainly is worse. So, first of all, as the previous gentleman said, other things, SARS, the Middle Eastern respiratory virus, Ebola, have relatively low transmission rates. This virus appears to have a higher transmission rate. So for every person that gets infected, on average, they infect two other people. That compares to the flu, where it's about 1.5 to 2, so it's slightly more infectious than the flu. It's probably as infectious as some of the more severe forms of the flu, a new pandemic influenza, the more severe forms of it. The common cold actually infects, the average person infects 6 people. Measles, for example, infects 12. So it's not as infectious as some of our worst viruses, but it is as infectious as something that that is transmitted pretty quickly through the population.
Now, you know, something that was reported on NPR this morning that the vast majority of cases, I think was reported 80%, show no symptoms. People show no symptoms. I mean, that makes it difficult to know whether you have been infected or not. What can you do about that?
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, it's going to be very hard for someone who has no symptoms to come to medical attention. And if someone has no symptoms and they can be tested and they can be negative because they're not sick, or they be and then a week later they could have no symptoms and be sick. Once testing becomes more available, for example, the CDC is going to do testing of more of the surveillance to try to determine if there is a reservoir of people who are infected and really aren't getting that sick. But that also makes it very hard to figure out how morbid or mortal this disease is. So, for example, the data out of China is that 80% of the people don't get infected, but 15 to 20% get hospitalized, and there's a mortality of about 2.5%. On the surface, that doesn't sound very bad, but with the flu, 98% of people are about 98% of the people are not sick enough that they require hospitalization, and only 0.1% die. The problem we have is we really don't know what those numbers truly are, because we don't know how many people are out there that have the disease, have a relatively mild illness, never come to medical attention, never are tested, and never confirmed. There's a general consensus that the mortality and the hospitalization rate are almost certainly lower than what's been reported, for example, out of China. And they're likely to fall much closer to the 1% range, the half percent range. I'm hoping they're going to fall as low as the general flu, but we don't know. So there's no.
Well, Dr. Goldman, one of the big questions that many people have is making the decision on when to get tested, how to get tested. I mean, there's been so much information out there that I get the sense that people are a little bit confused. Are they to go to their family doctor, make an appointment just like they would if, say, they did have the flu or a cold or suspected flu or the cold? How are they to go about that?
Well, first of all, the first thing they should do is call their family doctor. Because right now in Pennsylvania, most of the testing is being done through the Department of Health. The Department of Health is, for the most part, testing people with risk factors. And for the most part, people who have symptoms of the flu will have the flu. So one of the first things your doctor should do isn't test you for COVID-19. One of the first things, if you have something that looks like the flu, is consider testing you for the flu. Now, we actually, as of today, since all the testing is done through the Department of Health, most physicians' offices don't have this test available, and you can't just walk into a physician office, get the test. You can't just walk into an emergency room and get the test. Now, the Department of Health is extending its testing capabilities. UPMC is working on an in-house test. And as these become more available, there will be more widespread. The tests will be easier to obtain. But currently what we want people to do is call their doctors, call before they come in, and certainly don't show up at your doctor's or an emergency room looking to be tested unless you have, for example, traveled, especially to one of the areas where there's a lot of this COVID-19 going around. You know you've been exposed to someone with COVID-19, which in Pennsylvania, currently I believe there are only 6 confirmed cases, so that's very rare. And then people who have unusually severe diseases, so someone who gets really sick with what appears to be a respiratory infection and there's no other cause, is being tested. Part of the thing about this epidemic is that it's fluid. The ability to test is being ramped up. Currently, again, there are only 6 confirmed cases in Pennsylvania, so currently in Pennsylvania, this is still a rare disease. And so people will be tested first for common things. Again, there's an expression, common things are common, and you test for the common things first. There is a lot of active surveillance trying to make sure that we don't miss cases, but again, it's still very rare.
As in your experience and with this particular illness, if someone is talking to you or their family doctor and they're starting to talk about their symptoms, maybe even believing that they have the flu or a cold, what would raise a red flag? Or would it have to be determined by that test? Is there anything they could say to you that would make you suspicious that this could be a potential illness for them?
Absolutely. So the most obvious thing is I just got back from a trip to Wuhan, China in the last 2 weeks, right?
Yeah.
But also, there's an average, there's a list of countries that's increasing. So anyone who got back from China, Japan, Iran, South Korea,
Italy,
any of those countries, I would be more suspicious. And then if they have a disease that's consistent, what you would be looking for is somehow they came in contact with someone that might have a disease, someone that traveled to that area, someone who could have given them the disease. In Pennsylvania, today, there has been no documentation of community-acquired spread. So we're still looking for risk factors, and that would make people more likely to test. Now, that's today. So the situation is changing rapidly. The ability to test is becoming more. At UPMC Pinnacle, we typically go through the Department of Health. We typically do the testing through the Department of Health because we know it's reliable and because we know that if they are positive, they immediately get plugged into the type of quarantine mitigation we need to do to control, to keep the spread of the disease. My guess is as testing becomes a bit more available, people will be tested more frequently. And my guess is if it begins to spread more in the state, people will be tested more frequently.
Let's take a phone call from Dan in Reading. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. This is really important, and I appreciate the addressing of the coronavirus. My question is, I've been in healthcare for many years. I'm retired now. One of the worst places I would think a person could be right now is in a doctor's office or emergency room with people hacking and coughing. I'm wondering, have doctor's offices, have hospitals prepared for people coming in with flu-like symptoms? Because I've been in environments where that's happened, and I'm thinking that's the worst place you could be.
Dan, thank you very much for your call. And I have to admit to Dr. Goldman that I've heard this concern from other people that you go to the emergency room, you go to your doctor's office, there are people coughing, could be in close proximity with them without even knowing it. What about that?
So first of all, that's why we encourage people to call their doctors first, and that's why we encourage people who are only mildly ill to call their doctors and not go directly to urgent care, not go to an emergency room. One of the biggest messages we should keep that people can get out of this is for their own, is that we would like sick people to go to the emergency room. So if someone has only a mild respiratory illness, call their doctors first so that they can get instructions, sometimes over the phone. UPMC Pinnacle is in the process of trying to expand its telemedicine capabilities, so some of those people may actually be seen with virtual visits. That is in the works. We don't have that set up completely yet. And a lot of other countries have set up, in other places, particularly other countries, they've set up single testing stations. I think South Korea actually has a drive-by testing station. And we're considering how we can do the testing most efficiently with the least risk to patients. All of that is being planned for, and all of that is basically in the works.
You know, we've seen this video when this first started in China and then the other countries in which it spread to, of temperatures being taken as someone entered the airport, for example. Mm-hmm. Is that enough? I mean, obviously, the presence of a fever is one of the main symptoms here, but is that enough?
It depends. In someone coming from a high-risk area, so someone who came from one of the countries where there's an active outbreak, people are often being quarantined for 14 days, quarantined for the time that they believe the incubation period of the illness. Either sometimes if there have been large exposures, they've actually, for example, on the cruise ships, they've been under strict quarantine. Sometimes they're quarantined at home. But we would recommend that anyone who came back from an area with an active outbreak, one of those five countries, self-quarantines at home and checks their temperature. I believe it's twice a day. I think that when you are trying to get, you know, people in airports, you're looking for needles in haystacks and you're trying to prevent them from spreading to other haystacks. It's often hard to figure out exactly what you should be doing. I think monitoring for temperatures, especially in people who come from countries where this is occurring, where there's a more widespread outbreak, is certainly a good first step. I think if they're coming from an area where there clearly is a widespread outbreak, then some form of quarantine is indicated.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. I want to tell you about the Smart Talk road trip coming up on Thursday, this Thursday, March 12th. It's a special evening broadcast. We'll be broadcasting live from the campus of Wilson College in Chambersburg. The broadcast begins at 7 p.m. We'll discuss the alumni of Wilson College throughout history in honor of Women's History Month and the upcoming anniversary of women's right to vote. If you'd like to attend, RSVP at WITF.org/events. On today's program, we're talking about the coronavirus. Six people have been presumed with the still being tested for the coronavirus here in Pennsylvania. Our guest during this portion of the program is Dr. John Goldman. He's an infectious disease specialist with UPMC Pinnacle. If you have a question or comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You could go to WITF's Facebook page to leave a question or comment. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Lenore in York. Lenore, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm actually in Millersville, but thank
you
for
your
call. I'm calling because I keep hearing the advice to call your family doctor. And, you know, there are a couple years in my life where I was moving around, you know, I after school, I hadn't established care yet, or where I was working in restaurant jobs or a bakery and didn't have, you know, great health insurance or health insurance at all. And that advice would have just been laughable. And so I always get worried when I hear that advice, because there are a lot of people for whom that's just sort of sounds like a fantastical, you know, not realistic thing to do. So other than calling your family doctor, what are the options for people who are more vulnerable, people who don't have the means maybe to go in, even the $50 for an urgent care? And I think this is also a policy question. So what is the state going to do as a whole to take care of those who are most vulnerable among us?
Lenora, thank you very much for your question and a very good question. Dr. Goldman, what about that?
Well, first of all, UPMC Pinnacle has a nurse line for people without a family doctor. Calls to the nurse line are free. So someone who does not have a family doctor, does not have insurance, they can call the UPMC Pinnacle nurse line and can be seen. We can even arrange a video visit so that they can be seen without having to go to an urgent care, without having to go to an ER, without having to get the fees that are associated with an ER. So as to what the state's doing, I'm not in state government, so I'm going to have to leave that to people who know more about it than I. What I can tell you, though, is you can call the nurse line. We can see, we may even be able to arrange a video visit, and that's whether or not you're a UPMC Pinnacle patient, and that's whether or not you have a family doctor, and that's whether or not you have insurance.
That is a question we're going to have to ask of state government, because along these same lines, saw stories last week of people being encouraged to stay home if they're sick, and stories of people saying, well, listen, I work my job, I don't have sick time, or there's a possibility if I take 2 or 3 days off, I could lose my job. So there are a lot of policy questions, a lot of questions surrounding this. Dr. Goldman, you're probably not in a position to answer all those questions, but those are questions we will ask. Some other questions coming in from listeners. Trish asks, once you contact the virus, what is the time frame for a person to start to feel symptoms?
So it is generally thought to be at most 2 weeks. Again, a lot of this epidemic is in evolution and our knowledge is increasing. 2 weeks is probably the maximum. It probably occurs generally within the first week. So if you contract the virus, you would start to get sick probably within the first week at most. After 2 weeks, we consider people to have been exposed. If they're not symptomatic after 2 weeks, we consider them to be non-infected.
Greg from Harrisburg asks, how long does the coronavirus last on surfaces?
You know, that's an extremely good question that I can't give a good answer to. It is presumed to be like the cold and flu viruses, which last for at least, you know, for an hour or two on the surfaces. We don't have a good answer to that. We don't know whether it's 20 minutes, and we don't know whether it's as long as 6 hours. What we do know is that it almost certainly can be transmitted by contact with surfaces in which you touch a doorknob, a light switch, a desktop, and then touch your own face. One of the reasons that we encourage hand washing is that people frequently touch these surfaces, then touch their face, and then infect themselves. So we are, A, discouraging people from trying to touch their face. That's very difficult to do. And encouraging frequent hand washing, which is much easier to do.
Yeah, I didn't realize how often I touch my face until I consciously was thinking about it. And just during this show, I've restrained myself 3 different times from touching my face.
Yeah.
Dot from Middleburg asked, when you're talking about pre-existing conditions, why doesn't Lyme disease come to attention? I and many other Americans have Lyme disease.
First of all, when we've looked at who gets sick with this disease, unlike many other new illnesses, for example, H1N1, the swine flu, or probably the flu of 1918, they actually hit younger people harder. At least the data coming out from China, the mortality is like 0.2%. up until about the age of 60, when it starts to go up. People above the age of 85 do have a mortality in China of up to 15%. It's thought that Chinese men had a higher mortality than Chinese women. It's not clear whether women simply fight the virus off better, whether their immune system works better, or many Chinese men smoke, and so the mortality may simply be a reflection of more chronic lung disease from smoking. I'm willing to bet that in the countries that have currently had COVID-19, there are relatively few people with Lyme disease. As it comes here, it's possible that Lyme disease will be one of the comorbid conditions, but again, we don't have any data yet.
Now, you talked about age, but what about some of those other pre-existing conditions? As you also said, this has not hit young people with as hard as it has the elderly, unlike the flu or some other illnesses. But what are some of those pre-existing conditions that should raise a red flag?
The biggest pre-existing conditions are any lung disease, asthma, emphysema, heart, things like heart disease that affect the lungs. What we do know is that for other viruses, typically what happens is that, you know, for example, a lot of people don't die directly of the flu. They die when the flu sets off their congestive heart failure, their emphysema, their asthma. We're assuming that a similar thing is going on with COVID-19. It does seem as though people with lung conditions and heart conditions are more vulnerable. There's a clear increased morbidity with age. And again, as the epidemic goes on, we will get more data. What we really know now is that probably heart, probably lung, and probably age are all risk factors. With that said, the data out of China was that it was that there clearly were deaths among younger people, but they were clearly much less frequent.
Sherry from York asked, could you please provide some perspective on the number of people with and dying from the flu versus the number of people with and dying from coronavirus?
Well, that is a very good question. So in a typical flu season, we have somewhere between 9 million and 45 million Americans die. We have between 100,000 and about 800,000 hospitalizations and 12,000 to 61,000 deaths. In order to figure out how many people are likely to be hospitalized, to die from COVID-19, we have to know the real mortality, and we have to know how many people would be infected. You can come up with scenarios where if you use the mortality data from China and you assume that we're going to have, because it's more infectious, we're going to have 50 to 100 million people infected, you come up with a very large number of deaths, to 1 to 2 to 3 million. Most people don't think that is going to happen. Most people think that the mortality rate is going to fall when we realize how many, that there's a much larger number of asymptomatic people. But if you had, the mortality all go all the way down to 0.5%, and you had the typical flu, the high end of a typical flu season where you'd have 45 million people infected, you'd still end up with around 250,000 Americans dying, which is much more than our typical flu season. Our typical flu season is about 80,000. And we'd have many more than our typical flu season hospitalized. Unfortunately, we can't give a totally straight answer to that because we don't know what the true mortality is yet, and we don't know what the true hospitalization rate is yet, and we don't know how many Americans will eventually be infected.
Dorothy asks, as a follow-up to the gentleman who asked about coughing in the ER or doctor's office, could you explain the disease precautions taken, and she's talking specifically about masks, to keep patients from spreading illness to other patients?
Well, first of all, we have been preparing for this for quite a while. So, for example, we, for a couple of months, have had screening questions so that if someone came in from China, Italy, one of the countries where they would be likely to have had this disease with a compatible clinical illness, they would be masked, they would be brought back to an isolation room, and we were making preparations so that if someone showed up from one of those countries, typically, we will, if we know someone is coming that could be at risk, we will actually, you know, for example, if they show up there to their doctor's office and are sick enough that they need to go to the ER, they are actually met in the parking lot by a provider wearing a mask. They themselves are masked, and they are then brought back to an isolation room. So we have had extensive preparation to screen for people who might be at risk, and if they are at risk, to quickly isolate them so they're not in the waiting room, possibly exposing other people.
I'm looking here. We got a lot of emails, so I want to make sure that I get as many on the air as possible. By the way, we only have about 2 minutes left, Dr. Goldman. Report says, there was a listener says, the virus will only be spread a short distance. I imagine the atomized spray from a sneeze would spray micro droplets of extremely small suspended particles that could linger for quite some time. How far away and how long after a sneeze in a confined room or open space is far enough?
So what they, it depends a little bit on how long you're exposed and what the exposure is. So for example, if someone sneezes directly on you, that's clearly higher risk. What they generally say is within, what the CDC says is within 6 feet for more than 10 minutes, So close contact for more than 10 minutes, Now that it changes if someone, for example, coughs directly on you, sneezes directly on you, and you'd clearly get a higher load of the virus.
I only have about 60 seconds left, Dr. Goldman. How is coronavirus treated?
Right now, coronavirus is only treated supportively. We have a number of drugs that are being investigated for to see if they are, in fact, have activity against the virus. There is nothing besides supportive treatment at present.
Roberta asks, I've not been able to find out how long it takes for this disease to run its course once you have symptoms.
It's highly variable. There are people who get very sick, and it probably can probably take it long, as long as a couple of weeks. My guess is for the less sick people, it's like the flu, and they're likely to be sick for 2, 3, 4 days, as long as a week. Again, until we get more data, we don't have good answers to those questions.
Dr. Goldman, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. As you can see, a lot of questions.
Yeah.
We only have about 30 seconds left. Best advice to leave with our audience?
My best advice at this point is to be calm, to prepare, and by prepare, I mean wash your hands frequently. If you are older or have other medical conditions, the CDC is recommending that you can reconsider travel, especially in airplanes, and to simply watch where this disease is.
Dr. John Goldman from UPMC Pinnacle, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to leave it open because this is an ongoing conversation that we will be having. So not going to promise anything for what we have coming up on tomorrow's program. Go to our website, WITF.org. We had someone who requested those numbers for the Department of Health. Go there for more information.